Welcome to Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. I'm your host for today, Brandon Shea Mutella, and we have got ourselves a full house. The three brothers are together again, the three brothers from other mothers. Tom, how you been? You missed the last episode. We haven't talked since the start of December when we did our Christmas episode, and we've missed you.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I've been listening to the show, but I enjoyed the 39 Steps episode, and I got my little magazine report in there, and I enjoyed that. And thank you for carrying the torch without me. It's good to be back in the studio.
Yeah, excellent, and it's a good film too. Chris, how you been? How was Christmas?
Good. Christmas was great. I have just turned 28 last week, so I'm looking forward
nice.
To that. And like, woo. Again, nice to see you again, Tom. Although Tom and I did actually chat during December because he showed me the turkey. I think it was Facebook Live, it was Twitter or something, and he was like, can I just, and I was there in each other's kitchen just going like, wow, that is actually a really nice turkey, what are you going to do with it? And it was like a half hour conversation. I was like, this is delightful.
I explained to Chris how I took a knife and scissors and butchered the thing and put it in boiling pots, and he got a little intimidated by that, so I don't know.
I was a bit, because you were just like, oh, and then I'm going to do this, and I was like, right, okay, have fun with that. But no, yeah, it's been really good, and it is very nice to be back with my brothers and, you know, doing another Hitchcock.
Excellent, right on. And joining us is a very special guest, John Champion from Mission Log and Mission Log Live. And when this movie was coming up, he was one of the first people that I thought of. You know, I'm like, we got to get John on here, because John has just recently completed a once-a-month, two-year stint on Trek FM 602 Club, where they covered all of the James Bond films, and now you guys are covering some of the early Mission Impossible films as well. But who better to talk about secret agents than the slow-motion gentleman himself, the secret agent himself, John Champion? How you doing, my friend?
Oh, you blew my cover. Oh, man. Yeah, thank you. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. And yeah, certainly I've been a fan of the genre of spy films for a very long time. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that my first Bond film in a theater was The Spy Who Loved Me.
Okay.
But I'm sure that I had been watching them before that even, mm-hmm. Because my dad was a fan since the Connery days. Even just watching, you know, reruns of shows like Man from U.N.C.L.E. and Secret Agent and The Prisoner and all that stuff, mm-hmm. I fell in love with the spy world. So yes, I'm known now for Mission Log, talking about Star Trek and sci-fi, my deep love for that world. But any chance I get to talk about spies, sign me up.
Well, I'm thrilled, because this is the first time you and I have ever done a podcast together.
It is. We've been circling each other's orbits for a long time, mm-hmm. And seen each other in person on more than a few occasions, but now it's about time that this happened.
Excellent. I couldn't think of a better topic. But before we get into the movie... Oh, did you... Sorry, go ahead, Chris.
I don't think... It was only just because, like, you know, it's the first time I've met John, that sort of thing, and I was really going to make a joke about, like, oh, I didn't know John was into Star Trek, because what you can't see if you're listening to the podcast is... There's just, like, rows of the models of... I'm not a big Star Trek fan, but I presume it is the various... It's like a fleet.
Yeah.
And it honestly took me 10 seconds when we were talking before this, and I was like, I know that from somewhere. And I was like, there we go.
Star Trek.
There are more than a few starships behind me, yes.
I think the coolest one is that Enterprise D mid-saucer separation.
The one, yeah, and you would know that. They're not lit up at the moment. But yeah, but they are separated, and they have working lights, and they're neat.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm That's really awesome. Lucky that I get to sort of live and work professionally in that world that fascinated me as a kid. Mm-hmm. If you had told me at 12 years old, like, yeah, your office will have starships in it, and there will be a captain's chair in the lobby, I would not have believed you that was even an option of something that I could do in my life.
Excellent.
That's so cool.
So before we get into the discussion on the film, though, John, we got to ask you a little bit about your history with Hitchcock. Now, I know you're a big fan of North by Northwest. We've talked a little bit about that, and you and me got to put pressure on Matt so we can cover it on the 602 Club. But but tell us a little bit about your history with Hitchcock. What do you think of him as a filmmaker? Is he a filmmaker that you generally follow?
Yeah, I think I discovered Hitchcock a little later than most people that I was friends with who were also film buffs. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned North by Northwest, and that was a really important one to me. The first time I saw that movie was at the Alabama Theater. So I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, and we had this beautiful 1926-27 movie palace, the Alabama, that was built for vaudeville, has a Wurlitzer organ that rises up from the floor. But they also had a really great classic film program when I lived there, and they still do. And that is what introduced me to a lot of classic cinema. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm told that when I was about 8, my parents took me there, and I fell asleep during The Sound of Music. Mm-hmm. Not surprised there. But I really got an education both there and then when I lived in New York briefly at a revival house that just showed classic 30s, 40s, 50s cinema. So North by Northwest, I think, was my first Hitchcock on the big screen. Mm-hmm. And I loved that movie probably because, as I mentioned, I had come from already loving spy films and that genre anyway. And I was already a fan of Cary Grant. And this was sort of the perfect combination. It's Hitchcock really at the top of his game. It's Cary Grant. He's always good, but clearly settled into who he is, his on-screen persona. The effects in that movie are terrific. The pacing of that movie is incredible. And I think probably the next week I bought North by Northwest on VHS and wore a hole in it the number of times I watched it over the years. So that is one that I go back to. But what happened was that sort of reinvigorated my interest in going back and watching anything that Hitchcock had done. So movies like Psycho, which I think is genius, I actually didn't see until much later. It was movies like Notorious and Suspicion, and Rear Window, which if we're going to compare Jimmy Stewart, I like Rear Window far more than Vertigo. But all of these movies, I want to say that maybe I had two or three friends in Birmingham who were classic cinema fans as well. And they sort of helped encourage me to say, oh, yeah, you need to go watch this one next. Go watch this one next. So I'm not a Hitchcock expert by any stretch of the imagination. I think people my age, if we weren't catching revival house screenings, we sort of knew of Hitchcock as a character before we really knew the breadth of his films, mm-hmm. Which is not such a bad thing. You know, not a bad thing to see a director and a true artist have some recognition, some life of their own outside of just their work.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Right on. So other than North by Northwest, like what would you say is probably your favorite that you think might be an underrated Hitchcock film?
I don't know that they're necessarily underrated. I can tell you that two of my favorites are Suspicion. I think when mm-hmm. people say Hitchcock, they think Psycho, North by Northwest. But I think Suspicion is one of my favorites. It tends to get overlooked. And honestly, Lifeboat.
Nice.
Lifeboat is such an intriguing movie, and you've heard me enough on Mission Log probably say that I'm fascinated by episodes of Star Trek that play out like a play. Mm-hmm. You just capture a handful of characters in a room and let them go. Mm-hmm. And that's what's so exciting about Lifeboat, is you just get a handful of characters in this enclosed space and let him go, let it play out. Mm-hmm. And the director gets to sort of take a step back and just let the actors do their thing. So I love performances like that, and I love it when you can sustain a movie or a TV show like that, because typically in a movie or a TV show, we expect so much more. We expect locations and a lot of fancy cuts and everything. And Hitchcock could do that as well. But Lifeboat, the intimacy of that movie, I think, is fascinating.
Excellent. Right on. I think you're the first person who's given praise to Lifeboat. And I'm really looking forward to seeing it again. I've only seen it once. So I think it's pretty cool. And he's got
It's so good. But I'll also, just for fun, and again, not underrated by any means, but To Catch a Thief, because I love Cary Grant. So any chance you get him collaborating with Hitchcock, sign me up.
Excellent. Right on. Okay, well, I'm going to jump quickly into our trivia, and I don't have a lot tonight because there's not a lot of behind-the-scenes information that I could find on the film. And most of the normally I cover four actors, but two of them have been in previous films. So we don't have much for you tonight. But Secret Agent is a 1936 film directed by Hitchcock, loosely based on two stories in Ashendon, or The British Agent by W. Somerset. You're going to have to help me with this, Chris. Mom? Okay. Wikipedia lists the release date as June 15th, 1936, and the film has an 86-minute runtime. Now, normally I get my information from Wikipedia and Hitchcock Zone, but Hitchcock Zone actually didn't even have anything on this movie. It just says coming soon, so they must not have gotten around to it yet. And I don't think they're updating it much anymore. But John Gielgud, who played Edgar Brody and Richard Ashendon, was born on April 14th, 1904, and died May 21st, 2000. He was an English actor and theater director whose career spanned eight decades, and who, along with his contemporaries Peggy Ashcroft, Laurence Olivier, and Ralph Richardson, dominated the British stage of most of the 20th century. During the 30s, Gielgud was a stage star in the West End and on Broadway, appearing in new works and classics. He began a parallel career as a director and set up his own company at the Queen's Theatre, London. He was regarded by many as the finest Hamlet of his era and was also known for high comedy roles such as John Worthing in The Importance of Being Earnest. In the 50s, Gielgud feared that his career was threatened when he was convicted and fined for a homosexual offense, but his colleagues and the public supported him loyally. When avant-garde plays began to supersede traditional West End productions in the later 1950s, he found no new suitable stage roles, and for several years he was best known in the theater for his one-man Shakespeare show, Ages of Man. Although largely indifferent to awards, Gielgud had the rare distinction of winning an Oscar, an Emmy, a Grammy, and a Tony. He was famous from the start of his career for his voice and his mastery of Shakespearean verse. He's broadcast more than 100 radio and television dramas from 1929 to 1994 and made commercial recordings of many plays, including 10 of Shakespeare's. This is his only Hitchcock appearance. Peter Lorre played the general, and we spoke about Lorre on our episode of The Man Who Knew Too Much. This will be his final Hitchcock film appearance, although he will go on to appear into two episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents called The Diplomatic Corpse and The Man from the South. Madeline Carroll, who played Elsa Carrington, we spoke about her on our episode for The 39 Steps, and this is her final Hitchcock appearance. And Robert Young, who played Robert Marvin, was born Robert George Young, February 22, 1907, died July 21, 1998. He was an American film, television, and radio actor, best known for his leading roles as Jim Anderson, the father character in Fathers Knows Best, and the physician Marcus Welby in Marcus Welby, M.D. Young appeared in over 100 films between 1931 and 52, and after appearing on stage, Young was signed with the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. And in spite of having a Tier B status, he co-starred with some of the studio's most illustrious actresses, such as Katharine Hepburn, Margaret Sullivan, Norma Shearer, Joan Crawford, Helen Hayes, Louise Rayner, Hedy Lamarr, and Helen Twelvetrees. Yet most of his assignments consisted of B-movies, also known as programmers, which required 2 to 3 weeks of shooting, which was considered very brief shooting periods at the time. Actors who were relegated to such a hectic schedule appeared, as Young did, in some 6 to 8 movies every year. This is his only Hitchcock appearance. And lastly, there is no Hitchcock cameo in this film.
A summary of the film from Charlotte Chandler's It's Only a Movie. Novelist Edgar Brody assumes a new identity as a secret agent. As Richard Ashenden, he is assigned to kill a German agent going to a meeting with Arab leaders sympathetic to Germany. In Switzerland, Ashenden is joined by a professional assassin, the General. And, as a cover, his beautiful wife, Elsa. Courting Elsa is an American playboy, Robert Marvin. They mistakenly kill the wrong man. A sympathetic Englishman traveling with his devoted German wife and their beloved long-haired Dachshund. When the elderly gentleman is killed and his wife left alone, the General finds the mistake funny and laughs, but Ashenden and Elsa decide to resign. Ashenden and the General discover the German spy is Marvin. Not knowing this, Elsa departs for Greece with Marvin. At the station, Ashenden and the General find Elsa waiting for him. Seeing Marvin board the Constantinople train without her, they follow. On the train, Marvin finds Elsa alone and confronts her. Ashenden and the General arrive as planes bomb the train, and Marvin, dying in the wreckage, shoots the General. After a montage of successful Allied advances in Turkey, a postcard to London announces, "Home safely, never again, Mr. and Mrs. Ashenden."
Okay, so we're going to start off with a discussion of this film here, and I got to say, I'd mentioned to you guys off mic before that I watched this movie twice. This is actually the first time I actually had time to watch a movie twice in preparation for our podcast here. And my opinion of the film changed a whole star. I won't give you that rating quite yet, but it went up a whole star upon my second watch. Tom, you weren't here when we got to discuss the 39 Steps, so I am going to ask you first, what's your opinions of screwball comedies? And this is what affected my enjoyment of the film right at the beginning, is because I thought they were going with another screwball comedy, and I'm not a big fan of the screwball comedies, and that's kind of how the relationship is between Ashenden and his phony wife. So Tom, tell me what you think about screwball comedies, and how do you think it fits in this film?
I enjoy a screwball comedy, like the whether you're talking in the old time era or the modern era. And I know some of our Hitchcock films we've watched previously have elements of that, and I enjoy that. And I think it's a nice touch to be able to mix that in with a serious film at the same time. So I do approve of the screwball comedy aspects.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And John, how do you feel about screwball comedies?
I actually love them. And I'll bring up Cary Grant again to say that Bringing Up Baby, I think, is sort of the pinnacle of the screwball comedy. Mm-hmm. It's a terrific, fun film. He and Katharine Hepburn are amazing in it. And I didn't have an easy time reconciling that style in Secret Agent. Mm-hmm. There's part screwball comedy, there's part spy film, I feel like maybe an attempt to make a statement about war. Mm-hmm. There are all these elements sort of competing for attention, and it feels like they never quite landed on what the focus would be. So I think it's perfectly fine to make a screwball comedy film set against the exciting backdrop of World War I espionage. Mm-hmm. but there were elements of this that I felt didn't work. Mm-hmm. Had you lifted Sir John Gielgud and Robert Young and Madeline Carroll and said, go make another screwball comedy, that might have worked perfectly well. Mm-hmm. But in this, it just seemed like, well, all right, we're sort of pulling for the romance, and we feel like we're supposed to laugh at the funny bits. But oh, they also killed the wrong guy by throwing him off a mountain. Mm-hmm. We should not laugh there, yeah. You know. So it's a bit of a challenge, and you can make light comedy out of films that have serious topics. If you look at the Thin Man series, which is fantastic.
Yes.
Yeah, right?
So I love the Thin Man series.
Right. Yeah. So amazing films, right? Mm-hmm. So you can have topics about, you know, murder and death and sort of detective work, but have this veneer of stylish comedic sophistication. And this is a movie where I felt like, I don't know if it was Hitchcock's influence or not, but they didn't quite find the tone that would have brought it all together.
Yeah, see, I think what the issue is I don't know if you've seen The 39 Steps, John, but there was the screwball comedy aspect of that film, and I think they're like, because The 39 Steps was such a success, they wanted to bring that aspect in it. They thought that that was part of what made it, and it was what part of made it its charm. It's not my favorite part of the film, but it did resonate with a lot of people, and I think that's what they were trying to do here with this one. Chris, how did the screwball comedy work for you in this film?
It was, I mean, I feel like I'm just reiterating kind of what other people have said, but it was tonally very weird. because you did have this kind of, it's, you know, it's technically a thriller, but then you're supposed to have this kind of sparring Mr. and Mrs. dynamic going in and all that sort of thing. And I just, it's weird. It has a heart of very dark humor in it. Some of which works, and we'll come to that a bit in some of the performances, and that really works, and that's great. And then some of it, it just feels like they've pitched it completely the wrong way, and it's just gone completely off. So, like, you know, what John mentioned, where there's the bit where they assassinate Caper, who is, you know, he's this experienced mountaineer, and they kill him off thinking he's the contact, and he's not. And then it shows the reaction, and it's such a weird thing that I don't know why it's still with me, is the dog.
Oh, man, that was so amazing, that scene with the dog.
That messed me up a little bit, because I don't... Oh. But I was just like, are we supposed to think it's funny? Are we supposed to think it's sad? Are we supposed to... Because I just thought, oh, my God, the dog knows he's dead. The dog knows he's dead. That's why it starts, like, howling, and then, you know, she starts going, and it was just... I was just like, is it supposed to be kind of like... dying? Because then it fades to black, and then it opens up in the middle of the festival.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was like, is it because it just felt like it wasn't pitched fully into either camp? It was trying to have it both ways. It was trying to be, yes, this is serious, it has consequences, but look, it's kind of funny. And it's just, it did work.
Well, I thought that was one of the most exciting ways to actually build tension, though. And that's something that I'll always give a tip of the hat to Hitchcock. Clearly, he was a master of building tension. And those cuts between what was happening on the mountain,
the
dog freaking out, scratching, it actually got me to lean in. Oh, my God, what's happening here? You know. But tonally, then you cut immediately to something else.
Yeah.
You're thrown off balance by that. Okay, what was I supposed to think about that moment?
Yeah, exactly. You're supposed to brush it off. You're supposed to think, oh, you know, this was this and this was that, and it's just part of the thing. Or you, it's a weird one. I definitely enjoyed it. If we're talking about the film as a whole and everything, I definitely enjoyed it, but it did feel as though you were kind of constantly just kind of jarring from one thing to another. It wasn't totally what I would say is consistent, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep, yep.
Excellent. Tom, what did you think of the dog scene?
That killed me. The little puppy, and he's like howling. Like he should get a Best Dog Actor Award for that. the Milkbone Award or something. But no, I think that was very dramatic. It's an amazing sort of telekinetic connection between the dog and his master. And how did the dog know that the man had just died on the mountain? But is it Madeline Carroll playing Elsa? Or no, playing the German wife, and like she was creepy. She was a little dark, right? The older
German wife.
Yeah, yeah. She was very very dark character, and you know, fit that scene very well.
And that was a great distraction to throw you off to thinking, well, we like Caper. He seems to be sort of a nice guy, and maybe he's just holding his cover extremely well, but when you introduce this German wife, you think, oh, okay, well, there's something sinister and weird here.
Right.
So it keeps playing with your loyalty to the characters up until you discover the truth.
Right, Mrs. Caper.
Because this takes place at World War I, right? Like, this is during World War I is when this film takes place, right? But I got to mention my comments on the dog scene here, because... the dog scene is actually, I had the same thing. Like, the dog scene agitated me so much while I was watching it that, and that was when I knew I needed to watch this movie again. When I got to that scene, I'm like, okay, I need to look at this film again, because this is not what I thought it was going to be. And it had colored my perception of the first part of the film. And I'm so glad that I went back and watched it again. Because this scene, and I do want to mention some of the sound design in it. Hitchcock does some amazing stuff with sound design in this film. And this dog sequence is one of them, because as you cut back and you see them climbing on the mountain and you see Ashenden looking through the telescope, you can still hear the dog whining over those scenes. So the agitation is not let up, like the tension of what's going on. I don't think they were playing that for comedy at all. It was definitely for tension in my interpretation of it. But that was one of the most amazing sequences in the film. And that's when I'm like, okay, I've misjudged this film and I need to start again from scratch as soon as I'm done.
It needs two viewings, partly because of what you're describing, because there are so many sort of stylistic tricks to help throw you off, but then get you back on the path of the movie. And also just a lot of times with old movies, and particularly with this one where, if I'm not mistaken, I think it fell out of copyright. So there are just hundreds of bad copies of this floating around. It's the kind of movie that I would love to see a really pristine, restored version. What happens is, I was watching this on Amazon Prime, and what happens is, you know, end up with a third or fourth or fifth or way beyond who knows how many generations. There's a lot of noise. There's a lot of, you know, poorly exposed clips of film, a lot of bad cuts. I would also make sure that I go back and watch it with subtitles, because some of the dialogue in going for that screwball comedy style is very rapid fire, overlapped. You almost need the subtitles to catch a lot of the little details in the movie.
And then they talk with that weird accent. I mean, right, Chris?
I won't say anything. I'll make any gestures that can't be experienced by the listeners. So I'm just gonna, I'm gonna wave that one off.
So I'll touch on the sound design again. I want to ask you guys if you had any favorites with the sound design, because, you know, he really did some amazing stuff in this, from the organ in the church with the dead organ player, whether he was the father or whatnot, the coin in the bowl.
Oh,
where
that
they were
was
at
horrible.
That thing.
Yeah. I could not tolerate
the
that.
The church bell? the whole church bell sequence? The chocolate factory being so noisy?
Yes! Oh my
God. You know, the dog sound going over top. This is an audible feast, but most of it is not pleasant to listen to. Most of these crazy sound elements are like really weird and offsetting and really made me uncomfortable watching it. And I think that's what it was supposed to do.
There's a lot of tension in the scene at the German festival. And at first, like you said, the coin in the bowl, it's like a dance routine, like something you would have seen on Ed Sullivan with them spinning plates on the top of a pole. But the guy has a coin in a metal bowl and he's spinning it around the rim for like 5 minutes. Like, this is entertainment somehow, and all it really does is add tension, because there's so much noise, there's so many different things going on, that grating, irritating noise of the coin just adds to the moment for sure.
Yeah, I thought it was brilliant, and I'm glad you mentioned the chocolate factory, because I thought that was such a fantastic scene. You know, thematically, all the noise helps to drive home the story of the espionage, which is to say, okay, they're getting bad information, or they're acting on assumptions and bad information, because it's difficult to weed out the noise and get to the actual truth of the situation. So that playing with the soundscape helps to drive home the confusion of the movie, which is really cool. The scene in the chocolate factory I thought was fantastic. It was so cool. It was almost like a silent movie. And I imagine you'd have to approach it that way. Okay, we're directing everything for action, because it'll be layered over with just the noise of the machinery. And I thought it was absolutely brilliant to do that. But that's another reason that I would like to see a nice, pristine, cleaned up copy of this, because we're today we're listening to the soundtrack, with all this fabulous noise built in, but also the noise of age on top of it, just the static and the crackles and the pops.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I love the sound design of that scene. I love the sequence as part of... And I think it goes back to what we've been saying about how Hitchcock kind of ramps up the tension with each kind of almost third, really, in that the first third you think it's building towards caper, and it's like, oh, you know, he's secretly evil and the German wife or that sort of thing, and then it just gets dropped. And then they go, oh, okay, and then moving on, next thing, to the chocolate factory sequence, and oh, no, that's get dropped and that sort of thing, and then it's revealed it's Marvin, which I think is interesting, and I like the fact they do a twist in it. The only other thing I had to comment about the chocolate scene... is I love how they made it so obvious who the bad guy was. Mm-hmm. I was so entertained because it was like, oh, who could it be? Could it be the nice lady who gets annoyed when he throws the thing of chocolates on? Or is it the guy with the floppy fringe and the evil stare? Could that be him? I loved it. I love it in that really kind of cheesy, melodramatic kind of... In my head, it was like a Spanish telenovela when he popped up, mm-hmm. and it was like, dun, dun, dun. But no,
talking about talking about the comedy element with Peter Lorre as the general, and he's running through the chocolate factory. He's chasing the box of chocolates on the production line that has the note, the handwritten note sticking out of the edge. Yeah. He's smoking a cigarette, running through a sanitary food production facility, and. I don't know why all the men don't have to wear hairnets, but all the women are wearing their hats with their hair all tied down. But it was a very entertaining scene, and I love how once the alarm was triggered and they had to evacuate the building, suddenly there's 500 workers. How much chocolate are they making that they need all
this
these?
This is Switzerland, man. All this these, is other chocolate.
Yeah.
They're making
totally
chocolate.
Flashed me back to... the I Love Lucy episode where they're working in the chocolate factory, right? And there's all these, like, that's one of those cliche, what did they say about sitcoms, that every sitcom plot was an I Love Lucy episode, and that's just been repeated. So that's a very generic factory production line scene, and I really, really didn't appreciate the chocolate factory part.
Okay, so we've talked about some of the fun stuff here, but I want to talk about the part that really pulled this down in ratings for me. Like, I think if this element wasn't in the film, I might give this thing a 5. But I got to talk about Peter Lorre in this film, because it really bothered me. His character really bothered me. I love Peter Lorre so much.
But in
this movie, it was offensive. It was hard to watch. It was wrong on so many levels, and I understand that and it's a fine line that we do have to talk about when we watch these really old movies. And we've addressed this several times on this podcast, because not everything holds up, but, you know, I don't know the character's name, but every time he said his name, I was expecting him to say, "You killed my father, now prepare to die." Right. But, you know, like, it was blackface, but he wasn't playing black. He was playing, like, Spanish or something. Because they called him the hairless Mexican, even though he had bad curly hair. Mm. He had this bad mustache. But his face was darkened.
Yep.
And he was this, you know, he was sexist. And he was like, basically assaulting women constantly. And, I don't know if this is something that was supposed to be charming and funny back in the day, because I think with movies done in the 30s, this is supposed to have been like a charming, funny character. Mm. You know, like he's not very attractive. He loves women, but he's never going to get the beautiful woman. So we kind of have pity for the guy and whatnot. And so we don't really take him seriously for what he's doing. But I mean, like, the Ashenden's wife is like, this guy won't leave me alone. Mm. You know, like, when we're introduced to him, that woman is screaming to get away from him, you know, like, and then when we're at that scene with the spinning bowl, he's throwing chocolates into that woman's cleavage. And like, I don't know, like, I understand, and listening to critique of Star Trek nowadays, I do kind of be like, well, give it a break, it's Star Trek and it was the 50s, but I could really not get over this character, and this took a huge chunk of the rating off of the movie for me. So, Chris, I'll start with you on this one here.
No, yeah, I mean, watched it last week and then I watched it again last night, and I agree. It's a shame because there is actually kind of a great gem of a performance somewhere for me. But unfortunately, it's obscured in the fact that, yeah, he's playing someone who is incredibly, you know, racist and sexist. Or it's more that I love the idea of the character. Or maybe it's because I think Peter Law is, you know, a fantastic actor and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, it was disappointing. There are bits where it's really frustrating because it is like, yeah, he is basically, you know, for lack of a better term, browned up to play someone who he says, oh, I'm not Mexican, I'm not a general, I'm not hairless. And it's just, yeah, but that shouldn't be the joke. You know, make him kind of, because he's, at the core, he's like a charming killer. He kills caper, you know, he's very kind of ruthless and all that sort of thing. You know, that's interesting. That is something that I would love to see done in a modern film. But you have this weird, like you said, he is incredibly sexist, he's very demeaning. The fact that Law, who is a white German actor, is playing it is just odd. And, you know, it does have its historical context in the sense of, well, you know what? Blackface was still a thing, unfortunately. In fact, it's coming up in one of the 30s Hitchcock films, which I am going to be interested in talking about. because it literally is in the finale, and yeah, we'll come with that. We'll deal with that when we come to it. But it was still a thing. It was still, unfortunately, very much a thing in the UK at the time. There were still minstrel shows. It was still a thing, unfortunately, until about the 50s. You could still find minstrel shows in a lot of, like, the coasts and all that sort of thing, all the seaside towns where a lot of them made the business. So that wouldn't have been... It wouldn't have been too unusual. And the whole kind of, he's supposed to be kind of like a charming kind of, ah, come here baby, kind of, you know, just like a sidekick character. But then you can't have the sidekick also be the, like, kind of sociopathic killer at the same time, because then you're going like, oh, he's really funny, but he's also like thrown an innocent guy off a mountain,
right?
And then he's also
There was a throwaway line that I don't know if you guys caught, and I can't say it verbatim, I didn't write it down, but right after he chases that woman when we first introduce him, and Ashenden is talking with R.
I've got the line here, I think, for you.
He's chasing the women, and then he says, it's not just women that he chases, so I don't know if the implication was that he's supposed to be a bisexual character as well.
Maybe.
But it's just kind of a throwaway line, because I don't know what else they could mean by that. Where they're like, he's chasing after the woman, and R says it's not just women that he chases after. Something, I'm kind of paraphrasing here. Yeah. Do you have the line there, Tom?
Yeah, so Ashenden is introduced to the assistant, a short, greasy-looking man named the General. Chasing one of the secretaries upstairs during the middle of a bombing raid, Ashenden notes that the General seems to be a bit of a lady killer. Not just the ladies, quips R. This is from one of our source books here.
Now that I'm hearing that in our discussion, maybe then... That's not reference to his sexuality. Maybe it's the fact that he is an assassin.
He don't just kill ladies.
But not a lady killer. He's a man killer. Like, he's a killer killer. He actually kills people.
Yeah. So maybe it was like just a joke that didn't hit. But, you know, I interpret it as that he also chases men. But, I mean, I don't know. So I didn't know what they were saying there. But now that you're, after a little bit of discussion here, maybe it's the fact that he's an assassin is what they were referring to instead. So,
well, no, that's a good point that, you know, he's a lady killer in the romantic sphere, but he's also a killer, like an actual person.
Yeah, this guy's no lady killer. Like, these ladies just don't want anything to do with him. Yeah. I don't know. John, what do you think of this guy?
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought this up, because he's horrendous. And, you know, the nice thing about Peter Lorre and anything is seeing that sort of devious undercurrent where he's a sort of, like, little unassuming guy who could snap and do some real damage at any point. I mean, even in a comedy like Arsenic and Old Lace, where he's Dr. Einstein, he's dangerous, but he can still bring the comedy as well. I think that we can let certain things slide by looking at it and saying, well, this movie is 80 years old. Okay, but there are plenty of examples of movies from that period where you have admirable adult, normal characters particularly the men, who do not treat women this way.
Yeah.
The audience was savvy enough to look at a leading man type or whoever the lead would be in that movie and go, okay, this is somebody who we look up to, who is treating the women around him not like, you know, dismissible objects the way that this is. And what I was waiting for is a moment in this movie where Sir John Gielgud slaps the crap out of him for behaving the way he does. First of all, because it's awful, horrendous behavior. And second of all, because they're really bad spies. You know, it's like everything that they do brings attention to the fact that they are rank amateurs at all of this. So I kept thinking in my head, okay, how would this movie get remade now? Whereas people who are professionals, who are at the top of their game, and if there's somebody who's being such a sleaze, who runs the risk of blowing their cover every moment, this guy has to be put in his place, you know? So I can only let it slide by being something dated for so much.
Yeah. And it's not the actions that he's doing. Like, had the women been, like, quote-unquote, at least partially interested in him,
mm-hmm.
I think I would be giving it a pass because of the times. But watching it, none of these women are interested in him in the slightest. Like, the first one, she's screaming and trying to get away from him.
She runs out of an air raid shelter to avoid him.
She's like, I'd rather die.
I'll give you a quick quote from the Complete Hitchcock by Condon and Sangster here. It's been alleged that by the time of the filming of Secret Agent, Peter Lorre had become a hopeless morphine addict, regularly needing to get a fix between filming scenes, and this might explain his outrageous, unrestrained performances. So some of that character where he's over the top and over the edge could just be the real life drug addict overacting and being a bad actor. Like a bad person to work with, you know what I mean? A hard person to work with.
But it's also the director's responsibility to step in and say, take this down, take this down, take this down. Because the director has the vision in his or her head to say, okay, this is the complete picture. This part over here is competing for attention too much, and it's throwing off the tone. But again, that's part of the problem with the movie, is that tonally it's all over the place.
Yeah.
And for his Hitchcock to be as meticulous as he is, even from the beginning, I'm a little surprised that this would get would feel that that out of sorts.
Mm-hmm. Like, I look at that woman that he met that ended up working at the chocolate factory, right? And, like, my interpretation of this, based on the times, is that the only reason she's interested in him is because of the food, right? Because she's, like, eating. And I'm like, okay, well, that maybe kind of fits the time, too. If they're in the middle of World War I, there could be, like, food shortages and shipping problems going on here. So if she's, like, willing to, you know, succumb to this guy because she's getting food, like, that's a whole other story. Mm-hmm. But, again, I don't really interpret her as being like willingly with him in that room. She just wants food,
right?
Which is possible. I don't know, but that's kind of interesting with it taking part in this time frame as well. And you mentioned the bomb shelter, and I completely forgot to mention as well how the movie opens there with the bomb raid going on in that one scene, and like the R is like closing the shades and whatnot, you know, so that their lights are not showing, so that they're not a target for any air raids. Like, it's really, really, really masterful, really amazing. So I think we should jump into the topic now. We should talk about the spy aspect of the film itself, and some of the spy things that we see, and how they, you know, they kind of compare and are a little different than what you'd see nowadays in something like Mission Impossible or some new James Bond. But, I mean, we get some really fascinating stuff, and I think the first thing that we see is that guy with the long beard with that chocolate bar, right, which leads into the end of the movie, and he opens it up, and it's got that message on the inside, and they know right off the bat, the Germans know, that this author's not really dead, and he's actually is in Switzerland at the time. So, John, with you being knowing a lot about spy films, what did you think about the spy aspects of this, the secret gizmos and whatnot, and the secret messages?
Right. Well, first of all, I love this R. Because immediately you go to the James Bond trope of Q and M being Bond's contacts back at MI6. So that was kind of cool to see that and dated to World War I. Although stylistically, this movie seems to play very fast and loose with the time frame. Mm-hmm. Be very different if it were made now and the filmmaker was making a concerted effort to say, this is 1916 and here's what it looks like. This could have been really any time between then and 1936. The thing that I really appreciated about how the spy world of this movie came together is that, and it's very obvious, but it's so obvious that it needs stating, is that we're in a pre-technology world here. So there aren't, yes, they have conventional telephones, but those conventional telephones aren't everywhere necessarily, certainly before cell phones. Communication alone is limited. So you have handwritten notes that are having to get slipped from one place to another, like inside a chocolate bar. And the information isn't always good. Now, I was hoping for more to come out of Ashenden's cover being blown early in the movie, but it didn't quite play out the way that I thought it would, which is fine. But I love the idea that it was people struggling to put together the big picture based on extremely limited information and the inability to constantly update. Because if this were now, it would be somebody getting a message on a phone or in the bug that's in their ear or something else. And it would just be this constant flow. Okay, we have a new update here. We have a new update here. We have a new update here. I love it when a movie, because of the time period, gets to separate from that, and you're just relying on the wits of the characters. Mm-hmm. Now, that said, the wits of these characters, not always firing on full full power, all right? So, but again, tonally, that's part of the difficulty with this movie, mm-hmm. because are we a screwball comedy? Are we a war film? Are we an espionage spy film? Because the fact alone that you would have characters in this spy wartime setting struggling with the idea that they have to carry out an assassination, that is, well, I don't really feel like this anymore.
Yeah.
that's insane to me. And it's something that, even if you want to give a character who works on that side a little bit of doubt or second thoughts about their position in this, it'd be played out very differently today, where you have to actually take that seriously instead of just letting it be sort of a sudden change of heart in this. Mm-hmm. So if that was even a possibility that any one of these characters would just say, like, yeah, I don't really have a stomach for this spy life anymore, you know, then that would immediately disqualify them from being a part of that mission at all.
Right.
So it's a very 1930s, again, comedy fantasy type of thing, where it's these characters who are sort of unattached from any other responsibility. And they just get to decide, like, oh, well, tonight I'll stay in this luxury hotel. Tomorrow I'll be in Greece. The day after that I'll be, you know, this is the sort of thing that only exists in that world. Mm-hmm. So that lack of realism, I think, for a modern audience particularly, is very hard to deal with. Mm-hmm. For an audience then, and maybe for an audience now trying to appreciate it, you just sort of have to decide, well, what am I in this movie for? Am I in it for the light romance? Am I in it for the screwball comedy if I can get past the abject sexism? Or am I in it for the little bit of, you know, analog spy detective work that's going on here? Many of those elements on their own are good, but they don't necessarily add up. Mm-hmm. So that's my little rant there to answer your question about how I felt like the spy aspects held up. I'm curious to hear how the others feel about that too.
Yeah, I had a little trouble, but Tom, like, what did you think of that? I mean, even with that resignation letter, how did you feel about that? Where they're like, you know what, we don't want to do this anymore. We're gonna leave now.
Don't they call that, what is it called when you walk away from the army and you quit and you get court-martialed?
AWOL?
No, not AWOL, but subservience or whatever. Sorry? Anyway, there's a...
Discharged?
Yeah, it's like a military criminal offense to walk away from your assignment or to quit your duty.
Oh,
so that's quite a serious choice for them to make as military or as secret agent people. And yeah, like you were saying, it's a major shift in what's happening, and they treat it very casually. Like, isn't there a letter at the end when they announce that they're married in the handwritten letter, and it's like, you know, thanks for the mission, we'll never do that again, you know?
Right.
It's kind of like, you know, we had fun at your garden party, but next time let's go indoors, you know?
Right.
They treat it so nonchalantly that it really doesn't have that strong war, espionage, military credibility to it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, again, the cute parts of the spy action that is happening with the handwritten notes and, you know, that kind of limited technology makes it interesting for the day. We have to remember too that when we see the German handwriting and it's transitioning to, you know, to English, that's a film effect. That's for the viewer's benefit. That's like a subtitle type of idea. And they did talk a little bit about coding or coded language or code communication. So yeah, it was historic in that sense that it was true to the day. But again, it's not really believable that you're not really thinking these are some crack high level spies that we're watching here. Like it does lower the bar as far as how professional they are as spies. And hey, they killed the wrong man at one point, right? So it's not really that convincing that they are professional spies, right?
See, I want to address something on that, like, because at the beginning of the film, like, this guy Ashenden, he's just brought into it. They're just they phony kill him without talking to him. There, and then Ars in his place, he's like, okay, you're a spy, and he's like, okay, I'm a spy, right? And he just goes off, and I mean, like, it's he didn't ask for this. He was just recruited without his choice. So I can understand. I can buy his character being like, I don't want to do this anymore because I didn't want to do this in the first place. But you killed me, and now what do I do now? Like,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's that whole – I love that premise of, like, he storms into the office. What's this? I heard about you killing me, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not dead. I'm feeling much better. Yeah. No, it is a strange circumstance for him to be in. So, like you said, that kind of justifies his lack of commitment to the mission.
I want to talk about the Marvin twist because, you know, I kind of saw that coming pretty early on. I'm like, this character is so weird. Why is this character? Oh, it's because he's the bad guy. You know, like, it's just as I was watching this character, I kind of knew that he was going to be the bad guy, like, pretty right away. I was thrown off with the button scene. The button scene really threw me for a loop when they threw it down, and that guy's like, oh, I guess, well, that must be mine. But except for that fake out, I totally thought it was Marvin the whole time. And I'm wondering, Chris, what did you think of that? Did you see that coming?
Yes, but I wonder if it's some of the fact that we're looking at this from kind of a 2019 perspective. And we've seen the same thing happen in hundreds of films since, where it's been like, mm-hmm. oh, you know, the guy who barely gets mentioned on your team, who isn't like a wild personality, twist, he's the villain, or twist,
yeah,
you know, something wrong, or twist, it was the best. So I think we're just kind of, for me personally, I think I saw it going just because it was like, oh, well, yeah, because it's like, I've seen it done in about 30 other films. You know, or you do naturally suspect the government person, or you do naturally suspect the other person on the team, or that sort of thing. Yeah, I'll agree, the button thing really threw me, because I was like, I have no idea what the hell's going on now.
That was a great twist. It was, like, it, threw it down.
It was great, and that whole sequence then, you know, and you do just feel so bad for Caper, because all it is, if he did just shut the hell up about the button, he and his wife and his dog would have been fine. But no, he was like, oh, maybe this is my button. And, you know, now he's dead, so. But In terms of storytelling, I think it was interesting because it did allow for kind of... You kept thinking, oh... compared to something like 39 Steps or The Man Who Knew Too Much, there isn't really any, what I would say, are twists. You know, Man Who Knew Too Much, you get your heroes and your villains established pretty early on. And there's no kind of like, oh, twist, it was the police inspector who secretly... you know, kidnapped the daughter or whatever, or who did this, and he was behind the 39 steps or whatever. You know, they've got their own internal logic and everything, but I think this is one of the first Hitchcocks that really enjoys employing the, you know, the twist with someone who is a, if not a sympathetic character, they're on our protagonist's side, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh wait, you've been playing both sides, or you secretly have been the bad guy. So I enjoyed it, even if it was... I enjoyed the gesture more than the actual impact on the story.
Okay. Tom, what do you think? Did you see that twist coming, or what?
You talked about having to watch the film a second time. I wanted to watch the film a second time to figure out what happened, like what was going on. And I watched it, and then I went online reading summaries and just trying to like to sort out the sequence of events. So having the twist with Marvin, you know, he was an annoying character from the get-go. Like, he didn't really make a lot of sense why he was there. And the end, I kind of, like, had to, you know, had to scratch my head at the end to kind of figure out what had happened. So, yeah, no, I was limited by the... is it my own processing of the plot or of the film, or is it the film itself? But... I guess that justifies his being in the film to have him be the bad guy at the end, but otherwise in the early parts of the film he wasn't of much value, right?
Yeah. John, what did you think? Did you see that twist coming? What did you think of that?
No, I'll sort of reiterate what Tom said here. You know, in a movie where there's so much that doesn't add up anyway, just the fact that you would have another annoying character, oh, I'm so distracted by Peter Lorre's sexism. I didn't necessarily see the twist coming, but it was one other distraction where I kept thinking, well, this guy's sort of annoying as well. Mm-hmm. And he's laying it on a bit thick, so there has to be something more to him anyway. But then we just sort of lose track of him at some point in the movie. Yeah. And I actually watched this movie over two nights. So having paused it and then coming back to it, I at some point when they revealed his true nature, I was like, oh, wait, he's still in this movie. Right, yeah. Right. So there was at least a little bit of a surprise that way. But no, I mean, again, with a more modern sensibility, you would have hidden him a bit better. You probably would have given him a little higher position in their group of spies, just to throw you off even more.
That led to the other thing that I really had a problem with this movie was the climax, like the last thing there when Peter Lorre sits down beside him, puts down his gun, and then this guy just picks it up and shoots Peter Lorre. I'm just
I
like,
hate it.
What the hell just happened?
I hate that.
What is
so
this?
Much.
Like, I'm like, I did not like that at all, and I'm just like, good. I'm glad you put your gun down in front of that guy. You deserve to get shot.
Yeah, because like... even Alfred Hitchcock was like, okay, please, somebody kill Peter Lorre in this movie. Please.
Yeah. Anywho, I don't know.
What do you mean he's in two more scenes? No, kill him now.
Get rid of him now. Excellent. Well, let's touch on some final thoughts here, and maybe you can give a rating here. Anything that we missed that you want to bring up? John, we'll start with you.
Nothing that we missed really, but sort of, you know, you preface this by saying that watching it a second time led you to increase your score on this, and I wasn't able to watch it a second time, but I can say this, that getting to the end of this movie and thinking back on it as a whole did improve my enjoyment of it. Scene by scene, this is a mess.
Yeah.
It really is. scene by scene, you just, at least I found myself struggling to get through, like, oh, great, when is the next horrifically sexist moment coming? When are we finally going to get another clue about what's actually happening in the plot here instead of being distracted by the other stuff? But taken in a totality, the hallmarks that I look for in a Hitchcock movie are truly there. There's some terrific editing. As you mentioned, there's some terrific play with the soundscape. There is some really masterful tension building, particularly in the chocolate factory scene. Less so in the train, but you could tell that that's what they were trying to do, is really build the tension, ratchet that up from the time they board the train. What's going to happen next? What's going to happen next? And I also felt like by the time I got to the end of it, this movie actually went places. Mm-hmm. You know, it would have been quite easy to film all of this with just a handful of locations and a handful of moments, but they really went all over the place. Big set pieces with the factory, with the train, even with the scenes with the organ or going to the mountain. You know, there are all these moments that would have been pretty impressive for an audience in 1936. Yeah. And again, looking back on it, impressive now for an audience in 2019. So just given the plot, just given the actors, I might have looked at this and said, okay, I'd give this 2 out of 5 stars. Mm-hmm. But I'll actually go ahead and give it a third star because there was some attempt here to make it bigger than it was on paper. Mm-hmm. And that's really what you're looking for in a Hitchcock movie, mm-hmm. is anybody else could have taken this script and just let the characters sort of play this out. But what we're looking for here is, where's the hand of the director to trick me or at least play with my emotional reaction to what's going on? So we all fixated a bit on the scene intercutting the mountain with the dog. And that was great because I could feel my heart rate go up, yeah. because they're toying with me with the sound and with the quick cutting, with the action, leading me on my first and only viewing here to think, are they really going to do this? Are they really going to do this? Oh, yeah, they just killed this guy. It might be the wrong guy, you know? So I'll really hand it to them for that. And I will put out there again that my wish is that we get a super meticulous restoration, of this, like has been done with so many other Hitchcock movies, that we get a really clean version, maybe with a commentary or some sort of analysis to dig a little deeper into this movie, because I do think it's worth it.
Come on, Criterion. You're listening, right?
yeah, exactly. But warts and all, because there are a lot of problems with this movie, not the least of which is Peter Lorre, not the least of which is the tonal confusion here. But there's a lot to like. Mm-hmm. And my enjoyment of it greatly increased when I got to finish it and look back on the journey that I'd just been through.
Excellent. Tom, did you have any final thoughts and you want to give it a rating?
I won't go too in-depth because I think we've discussed it in great depth already. And kind of to summarize, the best part was the ending. The best part was when it ended. But no, it was good. And a lot of stuff specific to the era that we have to kind of work our way around. But I will go ahead and give it a 3.5 chocolates in a box that should have been 5 chocolates as my rating.
Excellent. Chris, did you give it a final rating? Did you have any final thoughts?
I mean, discussing it with you guys has kind of helped me work through some of my thoughts on it, because I watched it again last night and I just kind of went, I don't know. I don't know what I thought. And it was a bit like when John was saying, kind of like, you know, individually, it's a mess, but when you put everything together, kind of stand back, it like kind of, it's a bit like a Monet painting where each dot looks like a train wreck, and then you step back far enough, and you're like, oh, that's a face, that's a flower, that's cute. I didn't mind this. I can kind of swallow a lot of the kind of shitty things about it, in the sense of, you know, oh, the Peter Lorre, the kind of the weird rampant sexism and the Brown Fleet thing, it's disgusting and gross, but I can kind of swallow that because there are okay pieces about this. I think the set pieces are done okay. I will say I really, as impressive as it was, I laughed when they bombed the train because it was so obviously a miniature, and I just had a little giggle because I was like, no one's getting hurt off that. But yeah, I would say a final rating are three postcards announcing your retirement in the most unprofessional way possible for a spy agency. I do love that because it's just like, bye, we're sort of re-fake, not really, but really married again.
Sort yeah. of. Excellent. Yeah, I myself have nothing else to add to the discussion. I originally gave this a 2.5, and I tend to rate my movies high. Yeah. I tend to rate my movies high. So for me to give something a 2.5, I rewatched it and brought it up to a 3.5. So I'm going to give it 3.5 crying dogs. That's my rating for the film. But I got to say, you know, so Peter Lorre is really what took a full star off of this film for me for my rating. And the other half star came off because I was so disgusted that R was sitting in that sauna and that cigar was just falling apart, and he was just, like, moving it around, and it was just like, I can appreciate a fine cigar, and so to see that soggy cigar in his hand, I'm just like, absolutely not. That was a shameful thing to do to cigars.
Can I just say, when you were like, oh, 3.5, I'm like, I've seen half a crying dog on Twitter. It's no joke.
John, where can people find you online?
Give us a look at podcast.roddenberry.com. So my shows are there. Mission Log, Mission Log Live, The Trek Files, is in addition to the other shows on the Roddenberry Podcast Network. So you can find me personally on Twitter at DVDGeeks. And yes, on Instagram, Slow Mo Gentleman.
There we go.
Which I need to add to, for sure.
Excellent. Chris, where can people find you online?
Well, when I'm not busy kind of dancing around Europe pretending to be a secret agent, you can find me on Twitter at @hire_boy. I don't really do anything of note on there. I basically just kind of retweet a lot when I'm bored at work. I just talk about, like, oh my god, this song's good. Oh my god, this film's good. I also co-host a show called North by Nerd West. It's me and my best mate Emma Platt, and we kind of meet up every so often, have a chat, discuss all kind of nerdy stuff and kind of society and culture and all that kind of stuff, and that's really fun, and hopefully we're going to get some episodes out in the first half of this year. I also appear on a bunch of other podcasts, the most prominent of which at the moment is Eccentric Earth, which is a fantastic podcast, and it's basically Amy Walker sits down with a guest and starts getting their live reactions. I say live reactions because it's all historical, but it's their live reaction to a piece of history that doesn't get talked about much. So I've done everything from kind of massacres to feminists to cryptids. It's really fun. Definitely check that one out.
Tom, where can people find you when you're not eating all the chocolates?
Twitter, Tom Caldwell 3000, on Instagram as the Tom Caldwell, accept no imitations. And of course, we really appreciate it when people follow us on our Twitter and our Facebook pages relating to the podcast, and lots of feedback is always appreciated, for sure.
Excellent. You can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. Once a month, I host Melodic Treks over on Trek FM, which is all about the music of Star Trek. And coming out very soon, my friend Andy Farber and I did a great episode on the music of the era of Benny Russell in the episode Far Beyond the Stars. You can find me intermittently on the Cinematic Sound Radio Network with a show dedicated to electronic film scores called Breaking the Waves. And you can find me on Warp 5 on Trek FM every once in a while doing Enterprise podcasts. And every other week you can find me and Zach Moore on the United Federation of Podcast Network with Franchise Fatigue, where we're going over all the films in a movie franchise. And we're also doing Mission Impossible right now. That was our first ones there. So, excellent. So, thank you so very much, John, for joining us. I really appreciate you joining us today. It's been a heck of a lot of fun.
Hey, my pleasure, and I really appreciate the opportunity to have gone back and studied this movie, so thank you for that.
Excellent. Thank you so much to Jason Cullimore for creating our wonderful theme music. You can find him at jasoncullimore.com. Don't forget to check out Annie and Catherine and their podcast, Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock Presents podcast. And thanks so much to the guys at the Fandom Podcast Network for hosting our show, which you can find our show in their master feed, as well as in our own independent podcast feed. Well, that's all we got for you this month. Next month, Sabotage, the next film in the Hitchcock chronology.
I'm going to make you do every single film knowing that voice.
Sabotage.
Yeah. The Window!
Excellent. Yes. Until then, good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.